Welcome, everyone, to a very special seminar with Dr. Lou Mitchell. You probably recall that in January there was a terrible snowstorm and the church was closed. I'm not sure that had ever happened before, but Lou graciously agreed to come and make it up this Sunday. And he's promised that there'll be some bombshells, I think, in what he has to say. So do tell your friends to catch the recording if they couldn't be here today. And thank you, Lou, so much for coming. And will you open us with prayer?
Yeah, happy to. Good to see Yinz again. Or if you're from South Pittsburgh, Yinzall. No, that doesn't work that way, I guess. It's good to be back. I've been preaching at a little church out in Ross Township, just helping them basically keep the doors open. And we just have a few more at worship than we have here today. But it's been a good experience. Let's pray. God, we thank you for your servant C.S. Lewis and the way you have used what he has written and who he was, his life, and how he has shown us that we can be people of faith and people of intellect. Help us now as we look at this series of children's literature, the Chronicles of Narnia. Bless this time in Jesus' name. Amen. Just to remind you, C.S. Lewis was born in 1898 and he died in 1963 on the day John F. Kennedy died. And I think maybe Aldous Huxley, there was another one who died that same day. The seven book series, you can get them individually as I did as a kid, or you can get them all rolled up in one. When I was preparing for the other, we did several weeks on C.S. Lewis. I brought this to the beach and it was great reading for beach time. I'll talk about that book versus some other things in a moment. I've had a special relationship with C.S. Lewis. I am not, and I never claimed to be, a C.S. Lewis scholar. Whenever I teach, and Sharon can tell you, it took me about 2 weeks to prepare for this lecture because I have to reimmerse myself in Lewis. The seven books of Narnia were published from 1950 to 1956. The Oxford Companion to Children's Literature calls it, quote, the most sustained achievement in fantasy for children by a 20th century author. We know the beginning one probably better than any of the other ones, The Lion, Witch, and the Wardrobe. Let me just ask you, how many of you have read in the Chronicles of Narnia? How many of you have read all of the Chronicles of Narnia? Oh, no one. Okay. Very interesting. Well, we know The Lion, The Witch, and The Wardrobe, and we'll be taking time to probably more time on that. But we're going to try to get a sense of the whole series of books. Just a little anecdote. In the 1980s, I attended a conference at Wheaton College, and they have the Wade Center, which is a center for C.S. Lewis studies and others of the folks who met regularly, the Inklings. They met in a little bar in Oxford called the Eagle and Child, where they called it the Bird and the Babe. I've been there. I've been in the room. I have a picture of me hoisting a pint there. But in the Wade Center, they have a wardrobe. Now, it wasn't the wardrobe, but it was a wardrobe from C.S. Lewis's house. And you open it, and there's a note inside that says, not responsible for anyone who disappears while peering into it. Okay. Lewis and his brother, Warney, were always interested in this kind of fantasy stuff. In fact, as children, they developed a whole fantasy land that they called Boxham, B-O-X-A-M. Lewis started thinking about the characters in Narnia as early as 1930s. Now, the lion was not the first vision he had of Narnia. In fact, he envisioned and wrote some sketches, drew some sketches about a faun holding an umbrella in a snowy wooded area. Do you know who that turned out to be? No. Huh? Mr. Tumnus is the first person that that is encountered, the first Narnian that we're introduced to in the series. He began contemplating the faun figure with the umbrella, Mr. Tumnus. One of the main characters named Lucy was named for wait just a minute. Do I have them? Sorry, I had them out of order for just a moment. His goddaughter, Lucy Barfield, daughter of his friend Owen Barfield. However, he said that it was after reading Charles Williams, who was also one of the Inklings, who wrote a book entitled The Place of the Lion, that the idea of Aslan came in. And when he said, when Aslan came bounding in, the whole thing came together and got tied up in it. Now, there's been some question about what order one should read the books in. For example, this Chronicles of Narnia was published in, I don't know, the 80s or 90s, let me see, I guess it doesn't really matter. But it has a different order than we're used to. The first order in here is not the Lion, Witch, and the Wardrobe, but the Magician's Nephew. And then the Horse and His Boy follows the Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, and that's not the way it was originally published. They did it because the Magician's Nephew and a little bit of the Horse and His Boy look back, all right? They kind of, they give us a little of the history before the Lion, Witch, and the Wardrobe. But I don't like that. And the consensus in general is we don't like this. And that really, the first experience of Narnia that anybody should have is certainly the Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. The Magician's Nephew does predate it. And I think that's the creation of Narnia is in there. We'll talk about that in a minute. So we have done that. Okay, I talked about that. It's still the best way to do it, to read it with the Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe first, and then go to Prince Caspian, then the Voyage of the Dawn Treader, the Silver Chair, the Horse and His Boy, the Magician's Nephew, notice how late they are, and then the Last Battle. Scholars and even plain readers have wondered, is there any integration of the books? They seem to be so different in plot lines and even characters. The one consistent character, of course, is Aslan, the lion. But other than that, are they just a hodgepodge of things? When Lewis read The Lion, Witch, and the Wardrobe to J.R.R. Tolkien, who was also one of the Inklings at one time, Tolkien hated it. He saw it was just a jumbled up hodgepodge of images that were just collected and thrown together. And that's what some have said that the whole series is, just one thing after another that comes in. Of course, Tolkien himself developed the whole world and languages and great details. And not only did he have the books, but he had appendices that would go on and talk about background history and the elves and everything. Well, the question is Lewis thinking about some overriding thing? And, you know, the big stumbling block was, if you've read The Lion and the Witch and the Wardrobe, you'll know that the witch has such control over Narnia that it's always winter and never Christmas. And so when things start to change, Father Christmas shows up. And they're going, what? What? It's like it kind of blows the mind a little bit that there is this Father Christmas. Now, scholars have looked at, well, there's seven books, so maybe the key is the seven classical virtues: faith, hope, love, justice, prudence, temperance, courage. No. Others have said maybe it's the seven deadly sins: lust, gluttony, greed, sloth, anger, envy, pride. No. Others have said, well, seven, let's say the seven sacraments: baptism, these are the old names, confession, Eucharist, confirmation, marriage, holy orders, and the last rites. Seven. No. There are some, we do have Aslan, and Aslan, of course, is the Christ figure in it. And in some of the books, we see this very clearly, Christologically. The lion and the witch and the wardrobe, Christ is the Redeemer. He gives up his life in order to rescue one of the children. He actually portrays one of a very ancient view of the atonement in what's called what is it called? The substitute. It's not substitutionary atonement. It is a boy, I'm getting old because things just. Thank you for trying, but no, it is a ransom. It's the ransom view. That is that the devil has some hold on us, owns us in some way, and the Christ figure gives his life as a ransom for the others, and he tricks the devil into knowing in the Narnia there's a deeper magic that wasn't known. Yeah, that's a very particular view of the atonement. So in The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, we have Christ the Redeemer. I'm sorry, I'll stay behind here. And in The Magician's Nephew, we have Christ the Creator. He sings Narnia into existence. It's a wonderful thing. And then, of course, in The Last Battle, we have Narnia, Aslan the judge. He is the judge of those who end up going into his land and those who don't. Well, but there are four other books, and there hasn't been able to be identified quite the Christological images that might tie it together. Prince Caspian is about the restoration of the throne and of true religion in Narnia. The Horse and His Boy is basically about the conversion of a particular heathen boy throughout it. The Voyage of the Dawn Treader contrasts spiritual life between two special characters, Reep a Cheep the Mouse and Eustace, who is kind of useless, who turns into a dragon. And The Silver Chair is about overcoming a war with the powers of darkness. In this Christological application of Aslan, there's much of the life of Christ that's left out. That's why they've thought that isn't really what he's trying to do. There's no nativity scene, there's no ascension. There is a resurrection, there's a death and resurrection to be sure. There's not really a developed Christology. And again, the big hang-up is who? Father Christmas. We don't know why Father Christmas is introduced in there into Narnia. Well, a C.S. Lewis scholar by the name of Michael Ward, he's a contemporary scholar. He studied at Oxford. He did his PhD or his doctorate at the University of St. Andrews, studying with some other C.S. Lewis scholars. And he has put forth Oh, he used to be the one in charge of the kilns, which was where Lewis lived. So he actually slept in Lewis's bedroom and studied at Lewis's study, his den. So he's very much a C.S. Lewis scholar. He is presently a teacher at Oxford. Michael Ward was writing a doctoral dissertation at St. Andrews when he had what he calls a eureka moment, when something happened that made sense to him. And I will tell you, this is a radical revision, or what we might call a paradigm shift, in C.S. Lewis scholarship. Nobody else has seen what he has seen, and it holds up. It's been tested, and we're going to test it today a little bit, and it holds up. That Lewis, in writing the seven books of the Narniad, as it's called, all seven books, had something very specific in mind that he kept to himself. He kept it a secret. Nobody knew what he was up to except himself. Lewis himself writes something like this in a work called The Grand Miracle. He says, "There then comes to you a person saying, 'Here is a new bit of the manuscript that I found.' It is the central passage of that symphony, or the central chapter of the novel. The text is incomplete without it. I have got the missing passage, which is really the center of the whole work. The only thing you could do would be to put this new piece of the manuscript in that central position and then see how it reacted on the whole of the rest of the work. If it constantly brought out new meanings for the whole of the rest of the work, if it made you notice things in the rest of the work which you had not noticed before, then I think you would decide that it was authentic." The eureka moment. This, by the way, is a very academic. This is his doctoral dissertation, and it's called Planet Narnia. Planet is going to be a key word there. This is wonderful, but I would recommend one that's kind of easier to get through, written more for lay people than scholars. This is called The Narnia Code. It's by the same person, Michael Ward. The Narnia Code. He discovered that there is a code to the development of Narnia. And I'm sorry, that's all the time we have. No, I'm kidding. I bet you'd come back though if I said I was going to come back. Well, here's what happened. He was already engaged in doing research for his dissertation. But one night in February, around midnight, I think it was a Wednesday, he says, a Wednesday night in February, he was reading a poem that Lewis wrote in 1935, 15 years before Narnia. Of course, as a C.S. Lewis scholar, he had to absorb all of Lewis's writings. We never even touched on his poetry, but there's a lot of poetry, some major works that Lewis wrote as poems. There's the poems, there's the letters, there's the fiction like Narnia and the Space Trilogy. And by the way, the Code fits very nicely in the Space Trilogy as well. And then there's the nonfiction works, his apologetics, miracles, and all of the things that he wrote, all of them. The name of the poem was "The Planets." planets up in the sky, not plants, planets. And it was a vision of, he saw the words in the poem about Jupiter, winter past and guilt forgiven. Now, wait a minute, he said, winter past, this isn't a poem that C.S. Lewis wrote before Narnia. When he thought about it, he thought, wait a minute, that's the theme of the Lion, Witch, and the Wardrobe. Aslan coming, spring comes, winter is past. That's part of the conquering of the power of the witch and guilt forgiven. Well, he sacrifices himself for the guilty party, Edmund, one of the children who betrays the other children. And he says, wait, is there a connection with this poem about the section on Jupiter and the Lion, Witch, and the Wardrobe? Well, to figure this out, we have to talk a little bit more about C.S. Lewis as a scholar. His specialty was medieval and Renaissance literature. In fact, this is a book called The Discarded Image, an introduction to medieval and Renaissance literature that he gave at Oxford. Okay? This is what he gave at Oxford. Later, Cambridge develops a chair, a professorship for C.S. Lewis, this is in 1954, specifically about medieval and Renaissance literature. He lived mentally a lot in the medieval world. He immersed himself in it. And in doing so, he thought about the medieval view of the universe. In the medieval view of the universe, this is pre-Copernicus, pre-Galileo, it was believed that the planets revolved around the Earth, that the Earth wasn't a planet, that the Earth was the stable part of the universe, and the seven planets revolved around the Earth. The planets were, the moon was considered a planet. This is the hierarchy. I'm going in the closest to the Earth. The Earth is stable. The moon is a planet. Mercury is a planet. Venus is a planet. The sun is considered a planet. The medieval view was that the sun revolved around the Earth. This isn't news. This is what the world was viewed as. Really, it wasn't until around the 17th century that this view really disappeared. So we have the Earth, we have the Moon, Mercury, Venus, the Sun, Mars, Jupiter, Saturn. It wasn't until 1781 that Uranus was discovered. Neptune wasn't discovered until 1845, and Pluto in 1930 was downgraded to what was discovered, but then it was downgraded in 2006 as a dwarf planet. Well, when we think about it, the days of the week are actually named for the medieval view of the planets. The sun, Sunday. Sunday is named for that. Monday, the moon. Some of these we have to stretch because they go from English to other languages. But let me just tell you that that the rest of Saturn, Saturday, Thursday is Jupiter. There is a connection linguistically, but I'm not going to try to patch that together. Mars is Tuesday, Venus is Friday, and Mercury is Wednesday. In the Ransom trilogy, that's the name of the main character in the space trilogy. He renames he lands on Mars first of all, which Lewis calls Malacandra, and then later he visits Venus, which Lewis calls Perelandra, and Earth, the silent planet, is called Thalcundra. Now, the thing I want to stress about this is that this is serious academic work. This is not some fly-by-night science fiction or something like that. Lewis is studying, immersing himself in this world. The system at Oxford, as for an undergraduate in the study of literature, was to immerse oneself in classical literature, Greek, Latin literature, the whole world of it, politics, science, ethics, as well as literature in the original languages. So as Lewis prepared for study at Oxford, he went with, he studied independently with Kirkpatrick, and he learned and lived in Greek and Latin. He basically would take a classical work, and he'd have a lexicon or like a dictionary, and he'd translate the thing from the original Greek into English, and that's what he did day after day after day. It's what we would call a classical education. Alistair McGrath says that this was seen as a gateway to wisdom, not just an accumulation of knowledge, but to be shaped morally and culturally by immersing oneself in this kind of literature. Now, the closest we might come to that is what we might call a liberal arts college. Remember, Sharon and I have talked about this a number of times. It used to be that the purpose of going to a liberal arts college and majoring in liberal arts was that you would get an education, that it would round you out. You would take all of the subjects of it. Yes, you might major in one particular thing, but coming out, you would have been exposed to mathematics and science and literature and history and maybe religion and all of the other stuff. Well, education has certainly changed. We no longer educate people to be educated. We educate them to do something, to specialize. Part of it, maybe it has to be that way because of the way technology has developed over the years. All right, having said that, but that's not the way Lewis learned. So again, if you're going to be in medieval and Renaissance literature, he immersed himself in that world. In fact, he saw himself in a way as a representative of that world. Listen to in 1954, he is appointed to the chair of medieval and Renaissance literature at Cambridge. And he gives his inaugural lecture there. When professors are promoted, especially if they're going to an endowed chair, it's a big thing. The whole university gathers, and the person gives their first lecture. The president inaugurates them into the chair, which is usually subsidized and paid for some way or other, not out of the main budget. The name of the lecture was Description Temporarum, or later in 1962, it was published as They Asked for a Paper. That was the name of it. Well, even before this, Lewis makes it clear that in describing the medieval world, although he's delighted by it, he knows that there's a serious flaw in the system. That is, it's not true. He's not purporting to say that, we need to go back there because that was the truth. It was true for the people then, but we know scientifically, since Copernicus, since Galileo, that one, the Earth is not the center of the universe, the Sun is, and that the planets revolve around the Sun, and that Earth itself is a planet. Okay, so he's not saying that we need to return to it, but he does note clearly that we can and we should learn from it, though. We should know it. We should know how people in the past thought. Well, in that lecture, his inaugural lecture, he states that he sees himself as a quote unquote specimen of that era. Here's what he means. Quote, "I myself belong far more to that old Western order than to yours. I read as a native texts that you must read as foreigners. Where I fail as a critic, I may yet be useful as a specimen. I would even dare to go further, speaking not only for myself, but for all of the old Western men whom you may meet. I would say, use your specimens while you have them. There are not going to be many more dinosaurs." He referred to dinosaurs earlier. He said, "Wouldn't it be wonderful to have a lecture on a Neanderthal man by a Neanderthal? Now, it wouldn't be very erudite, but we would learn things that we wouldn't otherwise know. Because he's a Neanderthal." And he said something about dinosaurs. "If a dinosaur were to run in here while we're running away from it, we'd want to look back and we'd want to see what it looked like, how it ran, what it smelled like. All of that, a specimen." Lewis saw himself as an old Western man, a specimen. He was so absorbed in it, and he loved it so much that he lived it, and it showed in his writings. It showed in his academic writings, in his lectures. It showed in his fiction, adult fiction, the Space Trilogy. It showed all throughout Narnia. Each planet has a particular, what can we call, a particular atmosphere, a particular, what's the word he used? I gotta try to find it. Donegality, he called it. Done. Gality. If that doesn't work, maybe quiddity. Does that help? No. What these mean is the whatness of something, the essence of something, the characteristics that make one thing different from another. Each of the planets has particular donegality, quiddity. It has particular characteristics that are different than the other planets. Even the way they affect history, people, each one has its own specific characteristics. How late do we go to? Quarter of, okay, we're good. We might even get through all seven of them. In studying this aha moment in the poem, Jupiter is described. That's the first one he encounters. Now, there are particular components, concepts in the mythology, in the medieval understanding that were character, that were distinctive to Jupiter. Some of them were being jovial by Jove. Jove is another name for Jupiter. Kingly. And so he started looking at the lion, the witch, and the wardrobe. And he says, Lewis has put so much of the characteristics of Jupiter into that book. In fact, by Jove is mentioned a number of times. Jove keeps showing up. To be jovial means to be cheerful, festive, tranquil, magnanimous. Winter turning to spring. Father Christmas is the jovial character par excellence. He's the festive one. And he, in his lecture, he says, those born under Jupiter are apt to be loud-voiced and red-faced. He'd pause, and all the students would laugh because that's who he was. He was loud-voiced and red-faced. Observing what sign Lewis was born under. Father Christmas is the jovial character par excellence. Father Christmas is the nearest thing we still have to the jovial personality in our popular modern culture. Aslan, turning death to resurrection. The children jumping on him. He takes them on a riotous journey on his back. Donegality. The first time we hear about Aslan, it's in The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. And it is Mr. and Mrs. Beaver who educate the kids about Aslan. But now that Aslan is on the move, oh yes, tell us about Aslan, said several voices at once. For once again, that strange feeling, like the first signs of spring, like good news had come over them. Who is Aslan? Asked Susan. Listen now. Aslan, said the beaver, why don't you know? He's the king. One of the donegality of Jupiter is kingship. Jupiter is king over all the other planets. He's the lord of the whole wood, but not often here, you understand, never in my time or my father's time. But the word has reached us that he has come back, He is in Narnia at this moment. He will settle the White Witch, all right. It is he, not you, who will save Mr. Tumnus. Skipping on down a little bit. Is he a man? Asked Susan. Is one a man? Said Mr. Beaver sternly. Certainly not. I tell you, he's the king of the wood and the son of the great emperor beyond the sea. Don't you know who the king, who is the king of beasts? Aslan is a lion, the lion, the great lion. Then he isn't safe, said Lucy. I'm skipping. Safe, said Mr. Beaver. Who said anything about safe? Of course he isn't safe, but he's good. He's the king, I tell you. Lewis is using the Lion and the Witch in the Wardrobe atmosphere. Details, more than I can share, are about Jupiter. They're about Jupiter. The next, by the way, each planet, this isn't quite so important here, but we'll see it later, has a particular metal affecting the Earth. Jupiter's is tin. That's what it is. Prince Caspian, the second book, The Dawn of Galatea, is that of Mars. The metal is iron. What is Mars? Militarism, martial arts. It's also sylvanism, woods, trees. Mars in mythology is the god of war. So Prince Caspian has a martial flavor throughout all of it. There's the wonderful mouse Reepicheep, who is willing to engage anyone in combat. This little mouse. And he's called a martial mouse. Prince Caspian must fight and depose a false king by the name of Mires and a false religion. And one of the climaxes of the book is single combat between Mires and Peter, the High King, who is in Narnia an accomplished knight. Then there's also Sylvan, the woods. By the way, the book contains much marching. The month of March is a martial month. It's named after the planet. Also, March is the month when spring-like weather can come in, which means a renewal of the woods. Mars, March, renewal of the woods. And in Narnia, the trees become martial. They fight. Let me see if I can read a little bit of this one here. Have you ever stood at the edge of a great wood on a high ridge when a wild southwesterner broke over it in a full fury on an autumn evening? Imagine that sound. And then imagine that the wood, instead of being fixed to one place, was rushing at you and was no longer trees, but huge people, yet still like trees because, excuse me, their long arms waved the branches and their heads tossed and leaves fell around them in showers. The trees become martial in Prince Caspian. And when Aslan appears, He gives a battle cry. A war cry. Aslan, who seemed larger than before, lifted his head, shook his mane, and roared. The sound, deep and throbbing, at first like an organ, beginning on a low note, rose and became louder, and then far louder, till the earth and the air were shaking with it. It rose from that hill and floated across all Narnia, down in Mirez's camp. Men woke, stared palely in one another's faces, and grasped their weapons. Down below, that in the great river, now at its coldest hour, the heads and shoulders of the nymphs and the great weedy bearded head of the river god rose from the water. Beyond it, in every field and wood, the alert ears of rabbits rose from their holes, and sleepy heads of birds came out from under wings. Owls hooted, vixens barked, hedgehogs grunted, and trees stirred. Getting ready for battle. Aslan says, what's his name? Michael Ward is, so to speak, the true Mars Sylvan, Sylvanus. What he actually says is that Aslan becomes the incarnation of each of the characteristics of the planets. He is jovial. He is the king. He is the warrior. He does lead the armies. Now, how much time do we have? Okay, we're getting on to it. I don't have a whole lot of time to give you details, but I will tell you, I will just give you the rest of what he discovered. Prince Caspian, oh, he did Caspian. The next one is the voyage of the Dawn Treader. Dawn, what planet is that? The sun. The Dawn Treader is heading on a voyage to the east, to the sunrise. Its metal is gold, and gold factors into it. The Dawn Treader is about the voyage towards Aslan's company. Gold and sunrise, east, and even dragons factor into this one. The silver chair is the moon. What metal? Silver. The silver chair. It has to do with wanderers. And part of it is there's wandering below the ground in the underworld with images of silver as they go to free Prince Rillian from the power of the snake-like figure that murdered his mother. All right. The horse and his boy is about Mercury. The metal is Mercury or Quicksilver. The coming together and separating of this material. So it's about two boys who are twins, but they're separated. They're separate, but then they come together, okay, in this. And there's that. Swiftness. Mercury is the messenger of the gods. So there's a lot of running, horses and everything. There's also speech where the two Narnian horses do not speak when they're not in Narnia, but then they do recover it. They lost their speech, they regain it, they recover it. These themes are there. I think maybe one more. There's two more. The magician's nephew is about Venus, and copper is theirs. Venus is about amorousness, right? It's about a matrimony, fertility, motherhood, beauty. Aslan is beautiful, sweet, healing. He pairs off the male and female at creation of all the animals. He encourages the gift of laughter. He is evidently the Venus incarnate. The witch is where we first see the witch. Her name is Jadis, and she is tall and beautiful. A damn fine woman is what was said about her. And last, in the last battle, it's Saturn, and lead is it. Saturn, Father Time was considered Saturn. With the what do you call it? Scythe? How do you pronounce that? Sickle. We'll call it a sickle. Yes. Yeah, it's spelled S-C-Y-T-H-E, but we'll call it sickle. He brings, in this one, it's about the last things. It's about the end of Narnia. The last battle, it's called. The last king of Narnia. The last friends. The last days of Narnia. It's about how Narnia ends. Well, that's basically it. And at the end, representatives from each of the stories come together. Tumnus from the Jupiter story, Reepicheep from Mars. I went because we haven't been exposed to these ones. The planets as spiritual symbols. There's a code. That's the Narnia code. And you can see nobody saw it before. Lewis didn't write about it or talk about it. But it is unmistakably there. That's the Narnia code. Yeah, now I'll take questions or comments. Okay, go read them.
I'm asking, my question is, would you recommend that we start with the code, the Narnia?
Read them both.
Spoiler.
There's a chapter on each of the books. Okay. My cap, read the books. Maybe read the chapter before you read that particular book. I have to tell you, I haven't even scratched the surface on the references to the medieval world and mentality in each of the books. Okay, but read the books.
Why did it take so long for someone?
Because nobody saw it.
Okay.
Nobody lived in the pre-Copernican world like C.S. Lewis was living in it. Remember, he was a specimen of, he immersed himself in that world. Not everybody does. I didn't know about the planets and what all that meant before. Yeah.
What is the bombshell?
That Narnia is about the planets. Isn't that a bombshell? I don't know. It landed, what'd they say about Karl Barth? His commentary on Romans landed like a bombshell on the playground of the theologians. This landed on as a bombshell on the scholars of C.S. Lewis. Back there. What's that?
Now I have to read the story all over again.
Yeah, you do. I know you do. Yeah, I mean, see, if you haven't read the books and don't follow how do one relate to the other, it this might not seem like, you know, a big bombshell or a big something radical. But this shifts the paradigm. You know, it is paradigm shifting. I like that word, paradigm and shifting. Oh, can't do it. Anything else? Well, that's it. I have fulfilled my duty to you of lectures on C.S. Lewis. You're very welcome. Thanks.
Next week, Walking with God, we are going to be led by Mr. Wolf in a discussion. So please tell your friends and come. Thank you so much for today.